seed, and then we'll get into it now. See, when did you come to Georgetown? I mean, when you start school?
Well, my family actually came in 1948, and when I was a junior in high school, because my father became the registrar and director of admissions. He spent most of his time at admissions. And then I graduated from high school here in 1950, so I started college in the fall of 51.
Okay. So did you live on campus or off?
No, we lived at home. In fact, my parents kept students as boarders upstairs.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Now, where was that?
At the end of Military Street, just to the south.
To the south?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
A lot of people did that in this neighborhood, kept students.
Did most of the professors back then had kids at college age do that also?
Not very many. No, I think, no, it was not normal. Of course, we had to stop it, because the college built dormitories for students.
So they were
requiring male students.
Okay, so they were requiring even employees and professors who had children that were going to Georgetown to require them to live in the dormitories after that was done.
In the late 50s, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what's the first impressions that of course you had some early impressions about Georgetown. How were they different when you started college as opposed to growing up or being exposed to it during high school days?
I don't remember it being any different. It was a natural progression for me because, you know, we've been around the college. Both my parents are graduates here.
Okay.
And we just went from one building to another. And I knew most of the faculty members anyway because most of the faculty were members of the same church I was in.
What church was that?
Georgetown Baptist.
Georgetown Baptist,
yeah.
Sure. That church is sort of seen as the college church, isn't it?
It was for maybe 150 years, yeah.
Yeah. What do you remember about your first class as a freshman?
Most of my classes were in the Jolliel Hill Chapel, where the building had been modified in the process to include classrooms in the basement. That was not in the original design. And office, in fact, the presence and the dean's office were in the rear of that building.
Okay.
Most of that was given over to a variety of offices and classrooms, but I think I had most of my classes there in that building.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What were your impressions as a freshman?
Well, as a freshman, it was a strange combination. If the kids look back now, they would find it rather strange because it was conservative in a lot of ways, but yet fairly liberal in other ways, and it was reflecting the return of the veterans from the Second World War. Some of them were still here. The college had just gotten into an expanded athletic program. We had a real fine football program, basketball, all that. No girls program to speak of.
Uh-huh.
But the girls were mostly in one building called Rucker Hall.
Yeah.
And there they had rather strict rules on sign out and sign in and dates. And men could only be in the lobbies, areas, the parlors they call them, at certain times.
Mm-hmm.
And they built an addition onto it while I was here called Bristow Hall. Just extended one wing.
Uh-huh.
And the bottom part of that became the cafeteria. They didn't have the cafeteria, I guess, when I came.
Is that right?
So they built that cafeteria was the lower part, and they brought in a barracks building from an atomic energy plant south of us here in Tennessee. That was the bookstore. It was over here between the chapel and Giddings.
Okay.
There was a bookstore sort of and a grill and everything was in this army building.
Okay.
They had a bunch of army buildings, actually. There was the whole biology, science, some of the music stuff was in a building in the northwest corner of campus, in that low place down there, where the theater's located. Yeah, that was a big army. And a whole series of barracks up here where the maintenance shops are.
Okay.
Gosh, there were five or six of them.
Okay.
Big barracks up there.
Go
and trailers, about a nice 40 or 50 trailers in rows for married students. With college, you never had anything like that before, married students with families.
That was a new phenomenon with, I guess, the veterans coming back and they were getting married right after the war, and the GI Bill was paying their way through college.
Right. There was a lot of older ministerial students too, I think, mixed in there too.
Now, where did they come from?
Well, Georgetown was the primary training ground for ministers in Kentucky and Southern Ohio. And gosh, we may have had 20 or 30 graduate a year going into the ministry. And it's reflected now in the officials of the Kentucky Baptist Convention. You know, here we are 50 years later. They just came from all walks of life. And but all colleges had the same problem. With that GI Bill is really what was the main emphasis.
It flooded the campuses with...
all of, and you had to get trailers and buildings.
Now, is it your impression that at the beginning of your freshman year, that was one of the highest enrollments up to that
1950, 51. Probably, I've been told 1946 was a real boom year because of the veterans suddenly showed up and there wasn't anything for them. And there were no rooms, dorms, anything like that. And so a lot of them were housed in the gymnasium, I understand.
Oh, they were?
The gym, so that was a sudden change, maybe a third increase in one fall.
Okay.
I don't remember any sudden increases. And of course, we went into the Korean War in the middle of that before I graduated, and then the enrollment sort of was stable. I don't remember a lot of people being drafted out of school, but we were eligible, put it that way.
What, now the curriculum that you took, had you anticipated going into political science or teaching when you came, when you entered Georgetown?
Well, I knew what I enjoyed doing, and I just took what I enjoyed. I didn't really worry about, you know, how it fitted in any pattern or anything. I'd always liked history and political science, government. My father had been in government in Frankfurt. We came from Frankfurt here, actually.
Oh, okay.
And then I enjoyed physics and math, too, so I just took, and we had single teachers in subjects, too. We don't have that now. One teacher might be the whole department.
Yeah.
In math and physics, it was that way. So I just took what I enjoyed, and I didn't really worry about it.
So the faculty was rather limited in those days?
It was a
days.
Small faculty, a maybe, small maybe 30.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who were some of the more outstanding, in your mind, faculty that we
had? Well, we didn't really have anybody in political science. They sort of farmed that around. But Dr. Carl Fields was the head of the history department, and Horace Hambury. And in math, which I really enjoyed math a good bit. It was about the most challenging thing I think I've ever done. And Charles Hatfield was he was the only teacher. And he'd been doing that for 30, 40 years when I came. He actually had memorized the textbooks. You didn't have to, you just had to tell him a number and he'd go running off.
Goodness.
In all kinds of math and geometry and trigonometry and all that stuff, calculus. And Dr. H.Y. Mulliken was the physics teacher. He was in the basement of Giddings Hall. That was all physics down there. And he was an interesting teacher. Yeah.
Why were they interesting?
Well, he could project. Dr. Hatfield, the challenge was there every day. You know, it was all memorizing how to do math of every kind, and it got more complicated as you got into calculus and advancement, stuff like that. And physics, you were just sort of exploring the world. I've never really forgotten them. That was part of my introduction to nuclear physics, which I wrote my dissertation on sharing the atom, which involved some of that.
Okay.
So it all fitted together as I look back.
Mm-hmm.
I just did what I enjoyed doing, but it all fitted together.
So they didn't have a set curriculum back in those days?
Oh, yeah. It has been cut back some, but generally the first 2 years were all required courses.
Okay.
All required courses, yeah.
Just to make sure you got a variety or a breadth of knowledge?
Yeah, it was based on, I think, what the American colleges and universities in general did in the 30s and 40s.
Okay.
Some of the things they did then we don't do now, that they had required 2 years in foreign language, for example. We don't do that quite. We're just 9 now, but
oh.
It's 12 hours. And it was a required course in history. Everybody took 6 hours of history.
Mm-hmm.
And see, English is about the same. We did not require philosophy or public speaking like we do now.
Mm-hmm.
So ours today is probably a little bit more balanced to it, yeah.
More balanced than the 50s, you think?
Yeah, because, like I said, the basic root of all of college education is really philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And well, that was not required. In fact, we didn't teach a whole lot of philosophy.
Okay.
It was part of the religion, part of the Bible department.
They call it the Bible department.
Yeah, one of them taught philosophy. That's all we had.
Now, who was in the Bible department?
Dr. George Redding was doing it by himself.
Oh, he was.
And then Dr. Daly came, he taught Old Testament and philosophy.
Okay.
He later became the editor of the Western Recorder.
Okay. He was a Georgetown College graduate too, wasn't he?
No, he came from Georgia.
Oh, all right. It was his son that came.
I don't remember.
Yeah, he was here during the 70s.
Yeah.
With me.
He had 3 boys.
Yeah, well, one of them came here.
Yeah.
What about the social life? What were you involved in as far as the social activities of the college?
Well, it was different because you were pretty well confined to the campus. Very few people had cars, only the veterans. And entertainment was here. I never was really worried about it. VSU, there were all kinds of activities, and the Greek groups had their entertainment. We had a chapel twice a week where we all came together. See, we don't do that anymore. The whole student body came, had an assigned seat. Everybody had an assigned seat.
Oh!
And everybody came together, and it was worship, and it was all kinds of other things, but that just doesn't happen anymore, that the entire student body comes together in one place twice a week. When I came, they were doing it in Giddings, and they had to divide the student body. You only took half at one time. And that over there was an auditorium. They only took half the student body at one time and had a chapel once a week. And then
your family came in 48.
Right.
You weren't going to college then.
Yeah.
John L. Hill Chapel was not completed when you started?
It was under construction.
It was under construction when you came.
Yeah.
So they did have chapel in Giddings. Is that on the first floor?
Yeah, mm-hmm. There was an auditorium on the first floor.
Do you know if that's where they were having chapel after the old chapel building burned?
Sure. It was the original chapel. Before this, there was a building next door here was built called the Literary Society Library Building. I had a track and a basketball court in it, actually, gymnasium.
Yeah.
It was a small building. You wouldn't believe how it was in that one building. But when that burned, they went back to the Giddings. Giddings originally had a room in the front there.
Of course, Giddings from the very start when it was built was an all-purpose building.
Oh, everything was there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You had faculty offices, president's office.
Mm-hmm.
Registrar's office.
Science laboratories.
And all those kind of things in the chapel. And I guess the Manuscrafters had to...
They weren't around then. After the John L. Hill Chapel was finished, then they took that room in Giddings and they converted it into Lewis Auditorium.
Yeah.
With seats and a stage and a staircase went downstairs and they dressed downstairs and below all that.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that when I was here in the early 70s. It was right at the end of my time here that they had got a grant to restore... Or renovate Giddings.
Maybe, yeah. Oh, yeah, right.
Into what it is now.
Right.
So the president's office was in the back of Giddings when you were here.
Mm-hmm.
Who was president when
president
you...
President Hill, Samuel Hill.
He was president all during the time you were here?
Mm-hmm. Then he moved into the back of the John L. Hill Chapel, right? Gosh, 1952, somewhere along there.
Okay.
They moved over here. But when I came, his office and the dean's office and my father's office, who was registrar and director of admissions, were all in the first floor.
Of John L. Hill Chapel.
No, Giddings.
Of Giddings, okay.
Right. Well, then they moved over here to John L. Hill Chapel. And the admissions and director and registrar and dean of men were on the in the basement on the west side, and on the east side here, that was the business offices and the president's offices in the back, and the dean's office on the first main floor. You can't walk right into the president's office and the dean's office.
Okay. Okay.
But all administrative offices were pretty much in that. In the chapel building, John L. Hill Chapel building,
okay.
Downstairs.
Goodness. Well, what were some of the activities that you were involved in?
Well, I never thought we were cut off or isolated. Looking back on it, we didn't have a car. I didn't know how to drive, actually, because there were so many things going on. And since I was taking a pretty heavy load, 5-6 courses a semester,
mm-hmm.
and all those things, and I was in the chapel choir. And I got into the KA fraternity for just one year. And
only a year?
Yeah, I was only here 3 years. I graduated. And I ran track, which the big school I would never have been able to do.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I ran the 2 mile.
That was your competition, I mean your
athletic
event?
Yeah, right.
How did you do in that?
Well, I lettered. I wasn't really the fastest. It didn't matter how fast you were in that race. It's just who finished.
It was endurance.
Yeah, right.
Who was the coach then?
Brad Jones.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What was he like?
Well, he gave the impression of being a very tough athletic coach. He had a great reputation in Louisville. And he'd been in the state tournament with a basketball team out of Frankfort at one time. So he'd done it all.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one that's responsible for the field and the track and all kinds of things. And he's sort of a gruff kind of fellow, but he had to in what the business he was in to be sure you kept all the equipment and schedule. He's athletic director, basically.
Okay.
He didn't really coach much, except he did track.
He did.
Track.
He coached track, and he had other coaches for football
and
tennis and basketball.
He did golf too.
And golf and baseball, probably.
He never messed with baseball, but the baseball field was right out here. He's the one that arranged that. You wouldn't believe it. That baseball field was right there beside the football field.
Beside it, they didn't switch, alternate
well,
between it.
No, the football field, part of it became the outfield.
Okay.
And they always had to take down a light tower to do that. So it was an experience watching that in the spring.
My gosh.
Just one of the light poles had to be taken down. So they could play baseball. But it was not a bad idea, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, it must have been pretty hard ground to play on. I mean, I walk over that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, no, it's not the same as it was then, because Brad was very careful. He carefully nurtured bluegrass sod, right like in the orchard or the fields out here on the farm. It was not laid down grass
mm-hmm.
like we have out here now.
Okay.
It was about that thick.
Oh, it was?
Oh, yeah, it was. Beautiful. And they tore it all up.
What they do, put some rock dirt in there or to make it seems like it's harder.
Yeah, they came in and they cut another ditch on the other side and tried to crown it, make it have a curvature to it.
Uh-huh.
And then they brought in sod, which all died, most of it. You can see the remnants of the old field in the corners, if you're ever out there.
Okay.
In the corners. That's what Brad.
Okay.
Down, yeah.
Okay. And he'd been here a long time.
No, not really. He came in 1943. Yeah.
Okay.
So he'd only been here 5 years when I came.
But he was an alumnus.
Yeah. Yeah.
Too.
Right.
Who else was here of note?
Well, Dick Scudder came in sociology. I never had a class on and geography. And Coleman Arnold is my English teacher.
Now, he has a fairly significant reputation on campus.
Coleman Arnold?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was an interesting guy. He, George Tonian, that was under him, and all kinds of stuff like that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, what was distinctive about Coleman Arnold? But you never had him for class, I take it.
Oh, yeah. Sure,
oh, you did?
Sure.
Okay.
He was just a solid teacher with a good sense of humor.
Not, he didn't, not out of, I wouldn't call him charismatic exactly. He just solid with a sense of humor. Maybe that's the best way.
Was he primarily a lecturer?
No, it was sort of half and half. I use his technique today, actually. It was sort of a conversational approach. Of course, he was teaching, you know, basic English. And
basic English?
Yeah, and then English literature.
Did you have him for English literature?
I must have. I don't, no, no, I had Dr. Jones for that. Dr. Jones. He was still living.
W.B. Jones?
Yeah, I had him in summer school, actually.
Okay. Well, Dr. Arnold, and I, of course, he was here when I was here in the early 70s, still teaching, and he's an alumnus. I mean, he came across very much as a very methodical, quiet type of person.
Right.
I mean, how did students, how did he teach? I mean, we've already talked about he wasn't a lecturer so much, but.
Well, the best evidence of that is down in the English department area downstairs. His picture is down there. His portrait is on the first floor of this building. I think that's the best evidence of how he got along with students.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was Woodridge Spears here then?
He came right after that. I don't. I never had him in class. No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Orland Corey came about that at the end of my period of time, who was the drama, and his wife, Mrs. Corey, was the, she had the old art department by herself.
Okay.
And Orland Corey did the drama. And the tradition had come because of, that they always have a Shakespearean play. And I think he had a severe conflict with the administration over that. Because that was a major production every year to do a Shakespearean play.
In other words,
Lewis Auditorium, which was nearly not suited for that.
He didn't want to do a Shakespearean play then.
No, but it got just too big a big thing. For
it was a big. It was a lot to put together.
Oh, absolutely.
The scenery,
sure.
and the
money.
A bit, okay.
And then there were differences with the president, right after I left, over whether the college would be moved. I wasn't involved in that.
No, you weren't involved in that.
Corey, I think, and others were really upset with Dr. Edelman about an attempt to move Georgetown College to Louisville.
What kind of reputation did Dr. Hill have among the college community during your time?
I don't think I ever had a conversation with him. I knew his daughter real well. Janie Hill was her name, and he's had an older son, Sam Hill Jr. My impression was he was rather stiff, very conservative, autocratic. I think he presided at faculty meetings, and there was no discussion.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, he just ran it like he had run his churches all his life. But you really needed somebody like that at that time to keep stability. And you wanted good relations with the Kentucky Baptist Convention because money had been cut off in about 1939, long in there, the convention had cut all the money off. And with Dr. Hill coming in, that was relieved, that was stopped. And the money had accrued, actually. It was in escrow.
Yeah.
And he took that money and just repaired the campus is really what they did. They had every building just about was falling down. It was in bad shape.
Yeah.
They didn't have Memorial Drive out here. All those things had to be fixed. And that money, that's the way they got it. And there was a very close relationship between Kentucky Baptist and the school. I would imagine 2/3 of the student body were Kentucky Baptist kids. But there was a third who were veterans and not other things.
Yeah. Didn't he leave just as you were graduating, or just
he
after?
Came, he left after, after I left. Yeah.
Okay.
He was up in years, anyway, maybe 60s, but that time. Yeah.
Okay. So what were some of the other traditions that you remember? What were the traditions that the students followed back in your time?
Well, because of the closeness, I think you, the BSU was a lot stronger among the student body, had a choir of its own. The Ministerial Society was a pretty good sized group. There were a lot of kids that were going to be missionaries. You know, there was, it was literally a subunit to the Southern Seminary in Louisville. We sent maybe 10 or 15 down there every year to the, all the schools that they had down there, music and theology and all the rest of it. There, that's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because of the nature, the fact that kids didn't have cars. You had to invent ways to entertain. And one of the strangest traditions, if kids came on the train to school, they would bring their trunks with them, and the train would bring them over here to the station. It's just over the hill from the college here.
Oh.
And part of the BSU or student body would meet them and help them get into the dorm. Same with the bus station. You know,
okay.
There might be 200 or 300 would come that way every 1st of September.
So where was the train station? It was
on Maddox Street, which is two blocks over. Two blocks over.
Okay, toward the east? Or
yeah, the
I
east.
I guess that's the east.
Yeah, the railroads had to tear it down because they felt it was too big a liability.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Now, where was the bus station located?
Bus station was right down where the fire station is.
Downtown?
Yeah. Actually, that's an old car barn for interurban rail transportation. That's what that was built for. And that was the bus station.
Didn't there used to be, before your time, tracks going on
right.
Jackson Street?
Mm-hmm.
Is that where the railroads came, or was that a inner city transportation?
No, it was neither. As I was informed by Flam Smith after I wrote my book, and he said you should have, you didn't have that right. There was a small railroad, I don't think it was narrow gauge, regular gauge, but it was just a small railroad which ran from the train station up the hill down Jackson here, down to the bottom of the hill.
Mm.
Where there was a ice factory down there. Ice. And then it came back up College Street and went on back out to the railroad station.
Mm-hmm.
There was an interurban which ran from the fire station, where the fire station is downtown right now. That was the interurban, which
okay.
had rather large cars, single cars. And that would take you all the way to Lexington and back. And you could change in Lexington and go to Winchester, Frankfort, Nicholsville, all kinds of stuff, Paris.
Now, did any of the students use the interurban go to Lexington from
time
to time?
Sure. That was their entertainment. They only had any money.
but how much did it cost to go to Lexington?
I've never seen it. It couldn't have been very much.
Uh-huh.
It was not. They carried freight. They carried all kinds of stuff. The cars were rather large, maybe the length of this building.
Uh-huh.
And when I came, there were some of those things, similar cars, were on the FNC railway, which ran from Frankfort to Georgetown, came
mm-hmm.
into the same station. They had single cars and went on to Paris.
Okay.
But the main, we had two other railroads. The one out here is the Norfolk Southern. It was a southern railway at that time and was one of the best in the United States. In fact, it has never lost money. And it was double-tracked all the way from Cincinnati to Chattanooga, and there were trains all the time out there, good passenger service. Some of the best crack passenger trains in the nation came through Georgetown.
Hmm.
The Floridian was one of them. The Ponce de Leon was another one. The Carolina Special. There were maybe 6 or 8 trains a day, passenger trains. You could get all over the state. And then we had the L&N Railway out here at Payne's Depot. That's the origin of that name.
Payne's Depot.
I don't remember any depot being out there, but when it crossed US 62 out there,
yeah.
that probably was a depot of some sort. That was the first one. That was built in about 1840.
Okay.
That came from Louisville to Lexington.
Okay.
So you could, the story in the catalogs, they say you can put your trunk on the dang train in Texas and get up here with that trunk on the train until you get to the front of Rucker Hall.
Really?
Yeah. But as you have to change trains.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you would always be on a train on some kind of rail system all the way to Rucker. Oh, Pauling, either one. This building.
This building.
Rucker was a little closer to the street than we are. That was right
off. That's true, it was.
Right on the street. They didn't have the yard.
Yeah, that's true. it really was.
It may have been built for that purpose, honestly, come to think of it. So it was maybe 15, 20 feet to the street.
Mm-hmm.
But it was built in sort of a curve.
It was.
Not straight. It was a curve.
It was like a crescent.
It had turrets.
Exactly.
Above the parlors.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What kind of forms of entertainment did the students get involved in Lexington?
Well, some good, some bad. I don't remember too much trouble with that. Sometimes the Greeks would have their meetings over there, social gatherings. Since we didn't have much here, just the Lancaster Hotel is what it was called down at Main and Broadway, where the First National Bank, that was the Lancaster Hotel.
Oh, it was?
Yeah, it was about 5 or 6 stories.
Okay.
And they had a beautiful ballroom. Best dance floor I have ever seen. I've never seen anything like that since.
Huh.
I don't know what kind of wood they had on there. They also had a speakeasy downstairs and a pool hall and all kinds of stuff. So.
They still call them speakeasies back in the 50s?
No, I think it had been closed. There was a room behind the pool room that I understand that was the speakeasy.
Okay.
There. Yeah.
Well, I mean, was Georgetown dry during your time here?
Yeah, it had gone dry during the war. Second World War.
That happened to a lot of communities in Kentucky.
Yeah.
They went dry during the war.
It didn't mean that we were really dry because there was people would hire taxis to go 5 miles out the road. You know, there was a liquor store on the county lines.
Yeah,
so
like there. Things working well.
Sure.
What this does is.
It needs a good microphone.
Yeah, this is one of those table mics where you and I can both.
You don't have to put it up.
That's right. They were suggesting that over at the Oral History Commission of using that kind of a mic.
I'm just trying to. Is this on?
Yeah.
I'm just trying to think of some other phenomena. When my father was the director of admissions, the enrollment doubled while he was doing that.
This is why you were here?
I think the doubling was maybe by 67, 68, somewhere along in that. Or maybe it's a little bit earlier than that, during the Vietnam War, actually.
Okay.
But you have to remember the conditions back then, in the 50s, we didn't have a lot of competition. The Camelsville and Cumberland were junior colleges, were more like community colleges. There was no northern school, not even community college up there in northern Kentucky.
Yeah.
And you did have a few, a community, Ashland was in there, and Bethel College at Russellville, or Hopkinsville, I guess, it went out of business. It was a Baptist school,
yeah.
Or two Bethels, actually. And the universities were not quite as prominent. There was the University of Kentucky, which is the 4-year land-grant A&M university. The University of Louisville was fairly small because it was a municipal university. It was financed by the city of Louisville in Jefferson County. And Eastern, Western, Murray, and Moorhead were colleges, state normal colleges.
They're teachers' colleges.
Not universities.
What about Transy?
So, Transy was there, but I don't think we ever looked upon them as a competitor. They had their own problems because they were breaking off from the Christian Disciples of Christ Church. They were really a university because they had the Lexington Theological Seminary was right across the street there. But that moved and was completely separated. And Center was a very small, maybe 600 people down there. So I think my father felt where the competition came in is when they all switched to universities in the Camelsville and Cumberland in that big fight over whether to move Georgetown College. The resolution of that was to leave Georgetown where it was, to make Camelsville and Cumberland 4-year schools, and then put money into Kentucky Southern, a new school. Actually in Jefferson County, it was not actually in the city limits of Louisville. Beautiful campus.
Mm-hmm.
Totally unrealistic.
Yeah.
Because the state of Kentucky, the very next year, it must have been 60, late mid-60s, the very next year when Louis Nunn became governor of Kentucky, the University of Louisville was taken into the state system and they cut the tuition in half.
Oh.
And Northern was started, and that was a totally new competitor up there, four-year university in that area.
Yeah.
So we're lucky to be alive. And enrollment, it sort of stabilized. I don't think it really dropped a lot. It sort of stabilized.
Mm-hmm.
Probably because of the federal programs that came in during the Lyndon Johnson, the Great Society stuff, where you had all kinds of things you didn't have before, such as work-study, national direct student loans. And
so they were basically replacing what the GI Bill did.
Yeah, and better. It was actually better.
Uh-huh.
The GI Bill, you didn't make any money off that. That was about $100 a month. That's all you got.
And that was supposed to pay for housing,
everything,
books, and
everything.
Everything.
Everything, sure.
What kind of entertainment did y'all have on campus?
Well, we, I think every dorm, especially Rucker, and the sororities and others had all kinds of socials and meetings and didn't have dances.
Yeah.
And I don't think we ever felt we were really worried about that. Hay rides, and you were in your group or another group, and the interaction was there. You didn't have to date particularly because I was in the chapel choir.
Yeah.
Everybody got to know each other. We took trips all over the country. So there were some astounding events, even in athletics. I was telling Billy Brannock, I don't know if you ever talked to him.
Oh, yeah.
Billy Brannock, I remember him. He's a fairly small fella. He was a halfback on the
mm-hmm.
football team. He was a veteran. And they played Western Kentucky State Normal College out here, which is now Western Kentucky University, and nearly beat them.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't have maybe 30 people on the team. The whole team was only about 30 people.
Because each person played offense and defense.
Both ways.
Yeah.
But they nearly beat Western out here. The score was 12-6. What was that, I remember? 12-13.
That is almost beating them.
Yeah.
And y'all didn't have the extra points back then. I guess he didn't have the extra
points.
No,
they had extra points. I don't remember what happened. But it was maybe 12-13-6 or 7, something like that. But it was it was an astounding. The difference was that all the line were veterans, armed from the Army and the Marine Corps, as was Billy. Maybe they had a few fresh faces in high school, but they were all older people.
So what was the track, how did the track program operate?
Well, Brad, we competed against sometimes in triple. You bring three schools together. And I ran at Moorhead, I ran at Berea, not at Transit, Met Center. It was a schedule of schools from all over the state. All the events. Well, we had some we had to do away with. They had the javelin. Used to do the javelin.
Mm-hmm.
They had to stop that because of, we didn't have an accident here, but I think there was a boy killed in Kentucky someplace at that time. But the track out there was a 440 track.
Now, what is a 440 track?
That's one turn around.
Okay.
But it was a perfect, not what it is today. They changed it.
Yeah.
It was a perfect 440. And then Mr. Porter had paid, I think he paid for the building of a 100-yard dash right here. It started there, and it came right out this way. That was a
You mean
yard.
It started near the student center?
Yeah. There was a 100-yard
And it
track.
Went out toward the Hinton Field?
Yeah.
Okay.
And
it was a straight shot.
Yeah, 100 yards.
Okay.
I think they ran the 220 there, too. For 220, you had to go on out on the football field.
Okay.
And they did the hurdles here, too. So we don't do anything like that anymore. We had low hurdles and we had high hurdles.
Okay.
On this track right here.
Were the tracks, what were they made of?
This one was made of cinders.
The 100-yard
dash. Yeah, 100-yard was cinders. The other one was dirt, primarily. Yeah.
Primarily dirt.
Yeah.
They didn't know about asphalt.
They just couldn't afford it. Eventually they did.
Okay.
It was blacktop.
Okay.
But my memory is mostly dirt. But
did that
you only ran the 440 and 880 and mile and 2 mile, but just those four. You used the big track, the big oblong track. Yeah.
How did he condition you, Brad Jones?
He left it pretty much up to each individual.
Is that right?
You condition year round.
Oh, you conditioned year round.
Yeah, I ran.
So he didn't give you any kind of guided program to.
No.
I mean, you might do it on your own, but no guided program to get in condition.
No.
And you didn't practice together.
We didn't do too much practicing together. No, for what I did, I ran on the railway right away. That was the best place to do that. The Southern Railway right away was just excellent. It was cinders. It went for 10 miles out here.
Oh, okay.
And just to get, you get out there and ran as hard as you can, as long as you could stay up.
Uh-huh.
That was the way to get in condition.
Okay. So you didn't go lifting weights or...
Not for those races, kind of, no.
So that's how you basically condition yourself. You just ran long distances,
right,
as hard as you could.
Yeah.
Every day?
Well, a few days. Yeah. It took 8 laps around the track for 2 miles.
Okay.
Around 8 times. Mile was 4 times.
Right.
880 was 2 and 440 was
I guess that standard has never changed for no telling when.
That's based on meters. The mile is a U.S. American invention, to be honest with you.
Usually I understand that the inner lane is a fourth of a mile around.
Right, right.
And then, of course, the outer lanes would be a little bit greater length.
And he had lanes marked off.
Oh, even on the cinders in the dirt.
I'm not sure it went all the way around. Maybe at the starting, where you started right out here in front of the football.
So it really didn't matter if you were in lanes or not when you were competing the 2 miles.
Not long races, no. It didn't make a difference.
Everybody was jostling for position.
Well, you just spread out. It never was a problem, though.
How if you were running a track, how was your strategy as far as trying to win? Was there a strategy?
Yeah, the strategy, you got it in your mind. I was thinking about this a while ago. I was out there walking. You got it in your mind that you're not going to think about it. You just do what you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you hold out.
As long as you, so you don't really try to pace yourself in any kind of way.
Yeah, and of course, primarily the strategy was to when what I did was 7 laps around, and on the fourth one is where you tried to kick.
Okay.
Maybe the half.
So you just really basically try to keep in position
right,
for 7 laps near the front.
Yeah.
If
right,
you don't want to really take the lead, maybe in the
not
early
really,
stages.
Not really. No. You didn't worry about the leads. Just so you stayed up there.
Uh huh.
And then
somewhere in a position where you could kick.
Yeah.
Ahead.
And at the last, everybody else would start falling out, exhausted.
Yeah. Well, did many people come out to see track and field events?
Well, there wasn't a lot else to do on the campus, so you know, yeah, sure. It was right here.
So everybody.
Yeah.
Maybe
a couple hundred here and there. But all the athletics, football, basketball, everything, track was right here.
Okay.
Within eyeshot.
What was the seat? When was the season?
Track was usually in the spring.
Okay. So it really hadn't changed all that much as far as.
I really wish we had kept it. But that was another expense I didn't want to do. I guess in a new stadium.
Yeah.
The space is there, by the way.
Well, they
can
pick it up later.
Well, most schools are not interested in that. High schools do it, but most colleges don't.
They're into more soccer now, I guess.
Soccer
that,
for the kids.
That sort of replaced
the
track.
High school students, soccer. Soccer's a tough sport.
Yeah.
We do it for both men and women. So you didn't have track for women back then. You didn't have a whole lot of women's sports, period.
Well, what were the women's sports in the when you were here?
I don't think they had basketball or any of those things.
I was noticing in the early annuals of Georgetown, like the early 1900s, that women did have basketball and they had
and
tennis. And
there was a field hockey field. There's a field behind Rucker Hall where they had field hockey or something too.
For women?
Yeah. Rucker Hall was sort of self-contained. It had everything over there.
I know.
There was a built room called Uepian Hall, which was for drama and speech events. Not very big, but it served its purpose. The cafeteria was in the east side, so-called Bristow Hall. And they had it was virtually a small college in itself.
Mm-hmm. You were mentioning about that you didn't have a cafeteria when you came.
Mm-hmm.
Where did students eat their meals?
Well, there was a grill, sort of a hamburger plate, but that was with the bookstore in an army building. on the other between John Lee Hill Chapel and Giddings.
Okay.
There was a grill. I guess that's, and a lot of them ate in the homes where they boarded.
So a lot of students boarded.
Yeah. And sometimes, we didn't do that, but sometimes they ate there too. You got that as a package.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's why they used to call them boarding houses.
Right.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Were you ever, now I noticed in the annual that you were president of the KA.
Yeah, my one year. Yeah.
Now how did that get to, how did you get that position?
Nobody
just
else
being
wanted
there,
it.
Nobody else wanted it?
Right, yeah.
Well, what was the reputation of the Kappa Alphas when on campus when you were here?
Well, it wasn't too bad that they did have their parties off campus, but nobody really thought about drinking parties, and they may have had a dance over Joyland or something like that. But
yeah.
Pretty serious, I think. You know, everybody's trying to stay in school and survive and get through. You didn't worry about that.
What was their mascot or whatever? Is it anything like it is today?
No, they didn't mess with the Southern stuff too much. No, but Robert E. Lee's birthday and having parties dressed up like Confederate soldiers. Well, they do now, Big South. But no, they didn't have any of that stuff.
So it was a pretty serious thing.
Well, and they didn't worry about homecoming, and you know, half the guys were veterans.
Yeah.
And they were way beyond that kind of stuff.
Okay. They had enough partying during the war.
Well, they were on GI Bill and they wanted to graduate, and you know, they didn't stay out all late.
Yeah.
All hours of the night. You know, they were here to get out.
Now the house that they lived in.
Right.
Did you ever live, you never did live there?
No.
Did some of the K's live there?
Oh yeah, sure, about maybe 30.
Was that the largest on campus?
I suspect the Pi Kappa House is the biggest.
The Pi Kappa House.
Yeah, it was right out in front of the president's house.
Yeah.
Across the street there.
Okay.
That's a pretty good sized building.
Okay. What was their reputation on campus?
Not about the same. They're all about the same. LCAs were up the street. They're
okay.
All about the same. There wasn't a whole lot of difference.
Was there any independent
no.
Social clubs?
No. Well, the BSU groups like that. Most of the student body were independent. You know, they were not in the groups.
Oh, so the,
oh, yeah.
The independents made up most of the
yeah.
Okay.
Because Rucker Hall was, that's where the girls were. All
and then,
the,
and then you had Pauling Hall, that was the men's. That was the only, Pauling Hall was the only men's dorm on campus
yeah.
at the time?
Yeah.
Because Anderson wasn't built until after you left.
1957.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So you had Pauling Hall. Was it still, Pauling Hall still meant for ministerial students?
Most of them were here, yeah. This was mostly minister, not all of them.
Okay.
And then you had the Sigma Kappas and the KDs. Sigma Kappa House was over on Main Street, right next
okay.
to the president. And the KD House was on Estill Court.
Okay.
And then you had the three fraternities. The KAs were down here in South Hamilton. But the Pi Kappas were on Main Street and the Chambers Avenue.
Okay.
And the LCAs were about a half a block up the street.
Now, what were the LCAs?
Oh, well, they were just another fraternity. Yeah, about halfway.
Was that a Greek fraternity?
Yeah, sure.
Oh,
men,
okay.
Men.
Okay. I didn't realize, I never heard of LCAs.
Oh, well, they're still.
I was ready to get them calling the Ladies Christian Association.
No, they have a building over here now, still.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you lived at home, and you were in walking distance.
Oh, absolutely, sure.
Of home, so that really made it nice.
Yeah.
What were some of the other, now Dr. Hill started this building program, I think, of course, Johnny Hill Chapel is his main project.
Right.
Of getting it done, and then...
Yeah.
Georgetown didn't have a science center until the 60s,
mm-hmm.
right? So they all they had was those barracks down
mm-hmm.
on the southeast.
Well, physics was in the bottom of the basement at Giddings.
Okay.
And math was in what we call Highball Hall today. That was math upstairs.
Did you have classes in Highball?
Yeah, math was had one room upstairs.
Okay. And now, when I was here, I thought they had two rooms upstairs.
I had a literature class.
There
were other classrooms, but that one room had been Rucker's, Professor Rucker's classroom.
Is that right?
For 50 years.
I didn't realize that.
And Dr. Hatfield took that room over.
Okay.
That was math.
So he taught in that building.
Right.
Oh.
I never did take any biology, but biology was in that Army barracks building in the far corner, as was business, by the way. All the business classes were down there, too.
Okay. What was the library facilities like?
Well, the main library had burned right next door. Had burned in 1930.
Right.
Some books, it was a slow burn. It was not, we think of in a big fire kind of thing. It burned up an entire day. So they were able to get in there and get out a good bit of it. And it was put in what was called the Arts and Crafts Building. That's where the Enzer Library, Learning Resource Center, where your office is.
Yeah.
There was a building, or a very substantial building, was sitting there, called the Arts and Crafts Building.
Okay.
It was really built for machinery to produce cloth and had looms and things for the students to work and go to school.
Okay.
On the Berea College model. That was their model. It never worked.
Okay.
But that building was sitting there, so they took the books they had left, maybe 20,000 of them. It's a pretty good chunk. And they put them on the main floor.
Okay.
Of that building. Downstairs was religion. Those were religion class. That was the religion classroom. And upstairs, on the third floor, I guess originally, it was the periodicals, bound periodicals and things like that. So it wasn't a very big operation. It was enough. We didn't worry about it that much. And the Virginia Covington was the librarian throughout that whole period of time.
During your time?
Oh, yeah.
Especially, well, of course she was during my time.
Yeah, sure.
And also, what was she like in your day here?
Well, I got along with her real well. She was very...
What kind of personality did she have?
Outgoing, sometimes authoritarian,
uh-huh.
which you had to be. To run that build, that kind of operation down there. But she was right on you in every room and made sure that it was quiet and studying. And with the limited resources that she had, I thought she did a pretty good job.
Uh-huh.
Everything considered, I never felt the need to go anywhere else, actually.
Mm-hmm.
On the internet. Anything like that. No, it was good.
What was the scientific equipment like, do you think?
Well, physics was the one that was probably could be criticized because it was basically in two rooms in the basement of Giddings.
Mm-hmm.
But he was H.Y. Mulliken was a very innovative, creative person.
Uh-huh.
And he brought astronomy to the campus, and we had, for the basic experiments we were doing, it was probably enough.
Uh-huh.
And up on the third floor of Giddings were the chemistry labs. I never took chemistry. But they were very creative. Dr. Alexander was the head, did that. He actually converted the fourth floor of Giddings into a lab. That was a chemistry lab.
Okay.
We called the Dean's Room.
Yeah.
That was a chemistry lab that he actually built himself.
Okay.
So it was, the basics were there. It wasn't anything, you know, it was a problem of new machinery and inventions, I guess, today. But the basics were there. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Were you at the dedication ceremony for the chapel?
Yeah, sure.
What was it like?
Well, it went on a whole week. That's in my book. That was an experience because Dr. Hill tried to bring in top leaders of the Baptist denomination from all over the country. And I remember John L. Hill. He was a very distinguished, had white hair. He maybe had been 5'9" or so, but he was a bulk of a man, big head.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the first dean of Georgetown College when he left. And he became the book editor, or an official in the Southern Baptist Sunday School Board in Nashville. And he taught a Sunday School class for women, which had several hundred women in it. I think it was the First Baptist Church of Nashville.
Mm-hmm. It was.
And when he came up for the dedication, those women came with him, busloads of them came up here with him.
Huh.
At when he spoke. And I think they may have had the president of the Baptist World Alliance, you know, it went on and on there for an entire week.
Uh-huh.
As a church-related exercise,
mm-hmm.
which you can obviously the building was intended as a chapel-type church,
mm-hmm.
stained glass windows and all the rest of it. So it was, and the choir, our choirs were great, and music was great, and it was a grand experience.
Now, did your chorale sing there?
Oh yeah, sure.
What were the interior decoration or interior like? We had the stained glass windows.
Oh yeah. Well, there were some basic problems with the design of the building, which we're going to have to correct again, I understand. The aisles, there was one big aisle down the middle.
Yeah.
And everybody's complained about that because when the speaker gets up, he's talking to the aisle.
Yeah.
What he sees is the big, huge aisle, like for a wedding or something.
Yeah.
Right up the middle. There. And the heating system was always a problem. And the sash waste didn't work downstairs. It floods down in the basement even yet. Still, it was not. There was a problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a substantial building, no doubt about that.
Right.
And it was built as as the philosophy was then, as an extension of the Kentucky Baptist Convention.
Okay.
Church. That's what it was for.
Where do you think they got the architect from? I mean, the architecture.
Well, it's basic church architecture.
Southern Baptist church architecture?
I don't remember.
For the 50s?
Out of the 50s, the steeple and everything, sure.
I remember, it seems like from my childhood, and I grew, well, my first 10 years of life was in the 50s.
Yeah.
That it seemed like the Southern Baptist Convention, they had the services they offered churches if they were to build one.
Architecture.
Yeah, and
sure.
It seemed like it was sort of something like this.
Yeah, this has a false columns on the front, which sometimes you had the real column, real white,
mm-hmm.
Grecian, actually Doric or
Ionic
forms there. I think this is more Corinthian, but
yeah,
this is a sort of false columns in the front. That's a little unusual. But the main building itself probably was a standard form, yeah,
mm-hmm.
when it started. But then as they went along, then they had to add, they put all these things in, like the basement rooms and the offices up the back. And all
is that because they were starting to get, as they got money
right.
in?
Oh, we're getting bigger.
Uh-huh.
Enrollment, sure. Enrollment doubled.
Uh-huh.
Actually, enrollment. When that was started in 1946 or so, it probably was sufficient. But the enrollment doubled within 46, 47.
Mm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And actually, it's too small today.
We need it bigger.
I don't think anybody had any idea that we would be as big as we are now. Yeah. It's more like they were figuring on 500, 600.
Yeah.
And now we're about 1,700. So.
Yeah. Which is amazing, isn't it?
Oh, it's amazing we survived.
Yeah.
Because the competition is fierce. It's
yeah.
just absolutely fierce.
It's hard.
All the other schools in our immediate area.
Uh-huh. What do you, when you think about today, it's Georgetown's mission as and compare it to the mission that when you came as a student,
mm-hmm.
how is it different, or is it any different?
It has moved in the direction of secular education. I don't have any doubt about that. We were influenced by things that we didn't have any control over. Such as the government's programs for scholarships, and the government regulations on teacher certification was a major change. During that same period of time, the state of Kentucky literally took over certification,
mm-hmm.
and they laid down the law
mm-hmm.
Out of Frankfort. And we got into the teacher education business in a big way, especially in 1950 when we went to a master's program
mm-hmm.
in education, which today. And I don't see anything wrong with that, actually. I think it's the best blend of arts and science, Christian, you know, the teaching. But it crosses sort of thin line in there on separation of church and state. But that became a big function. Athletics became a big function as it is today. We're competitive, you know, nationally, and
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing. And is that related to Christian education? You could argue. And we furnished business people. and teacher and lawyers of every form.
Mm-hmm.
I think we drifted away though from at that time there was never any doubt that this was a Kentucky Baptist college.
Mm-hmm.
Never any doubt. The trustees were picked by the Kentucky Baptist Convention.
Yeah.
The president was always more of a theology. He usually came out of seminaries.
Yeah.
That stopped in 1960. And the teachers, at least the department heads, were required to be members of Kentucky Baptist churches.
Mm-hmm.
Not all the faculty necessarily, but
right.
there was a rule, sort of
an unwritten rule,
which the trustees enforced.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not true today. Which there's nothing wrong with it. If this school were to survive, that's what they had to do. They had to meet demand for had to be something here for the kids to do, right?
Yeah.
To take for something, to go on to have a job.
Yeah.
The blend has moved away more from the traditional liberal arts, honestly,
uh-huh.
to arts and sciences, business, education.
Yeah. Okay.
Subsidized athletics.
Now, the youth, what was the role of, and we don't have too much tape left, what was the role of athletics in your day as far as the overall philosophy of the college?
I think we were trying to compete competitively within our class, and at that time, believe it or not, it had been so far. We used to play Louisville, Eastern in basketball. Morehead, used to play Morehead
yeah.
in basketball all the time. We played UK in the 20s. We quit that in about 1930. But there were smaller athletic operations. You didn't have the massive UK athletic system. And we were trying to provide an attraction for men to come here.
Uh-huh. Okay.
To play athletic. The blend of athletics and education was a tradition within the American educational community.
Right.
College community.
Right.
Sure. And we were right in there.
Yeah.
Right in there. We did a good job. They did a good job.
Well, it sure has advanced from just playing high schools and when we first started football in the 1890s.
Yeah. Oh, we played everybody. We even played in the Miami, Florida in 1925 in the Orange Bowl.
Ah.
The same field. Didn't have the stadium, but it was the same field.
Yeah.
University of Miami. We used to play Cincinnati. Schools from all over the place.
Yeah.
And
of course, that was in the infancy of college football.
Oh, yeah. And it was really not subsidized like it is now.
Yeah. And it's not big business. It wasn't big business back then.
Well, it was business to a certain point.
Yeah, but not like it is today.
No.
Not like I'm...
Yeah.
Well, let's cut it off.
This is an unrehearsed interview with J. Robert Snyder, class of 1953. On September the 18th, in his office of Pauling Hall at Georgetown College. It was done as part of a project funded by the Kentucky Oral History Commission.